From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. The journalist Matt Kaplan has been covering science for decades. And in that time, he's written about bobcats that eat python eggs, super volcanoes in Yellowstone, city birds that use cigarette butts as tools, the psychological influence of bumper stickers, and the twisted sex lives of ducks. And behind each of those stories is a scientist, or a few of them, who had to take a chance in telling the world something new. But the world is not always ready for something new, especially when those ideas challenge what we've always believed before. And in his new book, Kaplan tells the stories of scientists who've been ridiculed, exiled, and imprisoned for being right. Matt Kaplan is a science correspondent at The Economist, and his writing has also appeared in National Geographic, New Scientist, Nature, and The New York Times. His new book is called I Told You So. Matt Kaplan, welcome.
It's really good to be here, Matt.
Matt, on page 176 of your book, there's a little footnote. And like many of your footnotes, it's pretty cheeky. It says, you didn't really think I'd write an entire book about scientists who were screwed for being right without bringing him up, did you? And indeed, Matt, by the time I got to that point in the book, I was wondering, because there is perhaps no scientist more famous in history for how he suffered than Galileo. And I'd like to start our conversation there, because Galileo's troubles really picked up when he got into something that I think these days we might call a pissing match with a fellow scientist named Orazio Grassi. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, of course. So Orazio Grassi was a Jesuit mathematician in Rome, and he was very, very focused on the Earth being the center of everything. And when a few comets went streaking through the sky above Europe in Galileo's day, Grassi wrote a report up saying, hey, I can see from the trajectory of these comets that they're going around Earth. And this is just more evidence that the Earth is the center of everything. Galileo was pretty capable with his telescope. And he looked at what Grassi was saying and went, well, this is just wrong. But he wanted to write a rebuttal. And in so doing, he wrote a piece called Discourse on Comets. He pissed off an awful lot of people, and he knew he was going to piss off a lot of people by writing that, including, you know, very well thought of scientists like Tycho Brahe, and certainly Grassi was going to be furious with him for shooting down the argument that the comets were in fact orbiting Earth. Because he knew that, he wrote with a pseudonym, but Grassi knew full well who the actual author was, and he attacked back. And as the spitting match, or as you put it, as the pissing match continued, Galileo eventually wrote Il Saggiatore, the Assayer. And this is, Saggiatore is really a pivotal moment in the history of science, because Saggiatore stopped arguing with Grassi on the matter of whether the comets were or were not going around Earth. It basically eviscerated Grassi's methods and demonstrated how his calculations and how the way he was doing what he was doing was just plain wrong. Mm. Now, Galileo wanted to be really careful with all of this because he was getting into dangerous territory, and he wanted to make sure that he had the church on his side as he was making this debate. And so he dedicated Il Saggiatore to Cardinal Maffeo Barberini. Now, I mean, you'll be forgiven, Matt, for not knowing who, do you know Maffeo Barberini? Does that just ring a bell?
I know because I read your book, but only because I read your book.
So most people don't know that Maffarini became Pope Urban VIII in 1623. Galileo in 1618, as he was having this battle with Grassi, he could certainly read the tea leaves. He knew that this ascension was coming, and that if Barberini didn't become Pope, he had a very, very good chance of becoming Pope. It was a likely conclusion to the battles in the church. And so he dedicated Il Saggiatore to Barberini, predominantly to protect himself. Now it is worth saying that Barberini, as a cardinal, was actually a Galileo fanboy. And so by dedicating his book to someone who he expected to be the Pope, it was a defensive maneuver. And it was probably one of the best moves of his life. So it's not like he walked blind into making this dedication, if you get my meaning.
Yeah, but this is sort of like all part and parcel to a theme of the book, which is that you might, as a scientist, get to have alternative ideas and share those alternative ideas without great risk or with lessened risk if you have charisma and connections. But gosh darn it, those aren't prerequisites for scientists, or they shouldn't be prerequisites for scientists.
The fact that it has to happen, and the fact that Galileo had to have these extraordinary political skills to be able to convince everybody to love him, which they did, is often not considered when you think about how far what he found went. But that was really so critically important. And there are so many scientists, both of yesteryear and today, who just do not have the James Bond-esque charisma that Galileo had.
And I love the idea of James, like Galileo in like a James Bond type movie. I think that would be, somebody should be working on that right now.
I mean, he was such a charmer. It's like, my God, everybody loved him. The children of de' Medici loved him. The Pope loved him. The ambassador to Rome of Tuscany loved him. His wife loved him. Everybody, like all these people, loved Galileo. And I think that that's really, that's lost in history. And so I really try to pick that up. And I reflect upon that a lot in I Told You So, because during the COVID era, when I was reporting 24/7 about death and destruction, it was astonishing to me how often people had ideas and said, ooh, you mustn't report that in the newspaper because, you know, it wouldn't go down well with my peers if that were mentioned.
Well, and let's carry that forward now, because you write, attacks do come from government. They do come from the church, the various churches over the centuries, but often and more powerfully from peers, from fellow scientists. Again and again, you write, for instance, that contrary to popular legend, Darwin did not really fear that the public would lynch him for his theory of evolution.
True.
So much as he was worried that the academic community would think less of him for coming up with such a wild idea as natural selection.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Darwin was, he spent almost two decades thinking about his idea, refining it, making sure that he defended himself on all fronts to make sure that his arguments were bulletproof. His perception of the church and his fear of public view was not at the top of his concerns. I don't want to dismiss that as not there, but it really wasn't the big deal that I think a lot of people make it out to be. And there's good reason for that. When you look at people like Joseph Lister and Oliver Wendell Holmes, and I mean, also modern scientists with COVID-19, the main fear is the peer group. So, I mean, for example, during the pandemic, one scientist said to me, Matt, you cannot publish what I just told you. And I said, why not? And she said, well, this is immunology and I'm a woman. I mean, the fact that I was having that conversation in March of 2020 was just mind-boggling. And I mean, I want to say 3 months after that, I was talking to a wonderful PhD student who had dealt with a ton of stuff in public health and had a lot of opinions about how Britain could manage monitoring of the disease to help the economy to recover and get things moving again. And he said to me, you can't say this, this, or that. And I said, well, why not? And he said, because my PhD supervisor thinks that I am being overly cautious and doesn't agree with most of my points. And at the moment, he is my god. And if I cross him, I could lose my PhD post and my funding, and that would be disastrous. I mean, and this is nothing new. I mean, you go back to 1840s. I write a lot in the book about an obstetrician named Ignaz Semmelweis in Austria. At the time, during the Victorian period, if you gave birth in a hospital, your chances of dying from your chances of catching a disease known as puerperal fever, or more popularly as child's bed fever, if you caught the disease, and 15% of the women in hospitals who gave birth did, it was a death sentence. The infection would spread from the uterus, go systemic, and within a few days, you were so horrendously ill with delirium, seizures, fever, and blue-black splotches all over your body that you would die. I mean, it was a terrible way to go, because even the gentle pressure of sheets was too much for women with this disease to bear, and they would lay in the hospital frozen in speechless terror by pain. It would always kill them if they had it. And so Semmelweis, he was an obstetrician, so he saw it all the time, and he really wanted to defeat this particular scourge. And he went to a lot of work, tons of work, to figure out why women got it. And ultimately, he figured out that the tradition in Victorian medicine of doctors going to the morgue every morning and examining the patients who they had lost the previous day, turns out that was not a good thing, because they had soap, they had water. Doctors would go and dissect their patients to understand why the person had died. And then they would wash with soap and water, and then go and work with patients the rest of the day. And Semmelweis worked out, hang on, after I go to the morgue in the morning, there's this odor still on my hands, no matter how much I scrub with soap and water. And it's not a nice odor. In fact, it's the odor of death. I wonder, and it took him years to figure this out, because he ran so many experiments to try to tease what the issue was. He ultimately figured out that if he took chlorine, which was being used in the sewers of Europe around that time to deodorize the sewers, if he took chlorine and put it in water and had doctors wash their hands in a bath of chlorine, it would neutralize the bacteria that were on the corpses and drop the rate of infection from 15% of all women, which, by the way, you think about how many women give birth every year, 15% dying is crazy, up to zero.
Yeah. Think about
that.
15%
and
this is pre-germ theory. So he's working this out by association and correlation and then observation. And the fellow physicians and scientists of the time, many of them, instead of looking at his data and looking at the results, they attack him.
Oh, it was horrendous. I mean, very, very few looked at the numbers and understood them well enough to say, "Ooh, you know what? That's pretty serious." And so most said, "Sir, we are gentlemen. How dare you tell us that our hands are dirty?" And it didn't matter that he was showing them concrete data to support his findings. Many just didn't care. And so for all of his efforts, he was ultimately thrown in an insane asylum where he died.
Yeah. There's another piece of this. It's not just the risk of being proven wrong or being entrenched in an idea and unwilling to leave it. It's a resource allocation question. The systems biology pioneer Lee Hood once told me that one of the biggest obstacles to getting support from other scientists for the Human Genome Project was that other scientists were worried that it would eat up all the funding that could be used for other important work.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I interviewed Kati Kariko, who developed the mRNA mechanism that was ultimately used in the COVID vaccine, and earned her and her colleague Drew Weissman the Nobel Prize, rightly so. But Kati, as I was talking to her, said, what really frustrates me about science is when I talk to a scientist and they say, oh my God, did you see the paper that was published in Nature this morning? This other research group has come by evidence to prove a point that I've been trying to prove for years, and they've beaten me to it. This is the end of my career. I'm not going to get any further funding. I have lost. In the hyper-competitive environment that we find ourselves today, and of course competition goes up as resource allocation goes down. So as we're all fighting for the same resources, the competition gets even more extreme, and this ability to be collaborative is hamstrung. This is, you know, the extreme competition doesn't bring out the best in people. And if we're going to defeat the really serious problems that we face in science, forget science. If we're going to face the really serious problems that we face in society, feeding 8 billion people, defeating climate change, getting rid of cancer. I mean, we're getting there, but it's a process. These are really serious problems. The energy crisis. If we do not start working together more collaboratively and allow fraud and competition to erode science from the inside, we're in really big trouble.
The scientist on scientist vitriol hasn't gone away. Pretty early in your book, you talk about a conference you attended in North Carolina, I think, mm-hmm. in which two women, one of them was quite young, were surrounded by quite a few angry men, as you describe them, shouting about, of all things, whether we can know what color dinosaurs were.
Yeah. It was, that was horrible. The researcher was Mary Schweitzer, who is amazing. And she's demonstrated that we can actually look inside dinosaur bones and find heme, which is an element of blood, to understand all kinds of microbiological stuff about what was going on inside dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. And one of her PhD students had, people had been arguing for years that you could look at pigment cells inside feathers that had fossilized and see little bits of pigment known as chromatophores to determine what color the dinosaur was. And her PhD student took feathers from birds alive today and buried them in her garden and then dug them up, you know, months later and said, I cannot see the difference between the pigment cells and bacteria. So how do we know that what we're seeing on fossils of dinosaurs 70 million years ago are in fact the pigment cells and not fossilized bacteria? How are you sure? And this PhD student had produced a poster at this conference in Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina. And the poster I thought was pretty well written, but I think I was maybe three rows down at the poster session. You know, as I rounded the corner to figure out what the hell was going on here, I turned the corner. I found this group of old, angry white men shouting at this, you know, 20-year-old woman. And when I saw what the poster was and I realized what it was all about, you have to remember that back in that time, so this is, you know, 2012, 2013, somewhere in that window. I can't remember exactly when. I've got it in my notes. But dinosaurs were gracing the cover of journals like Nature and Science in color. Mm-hmm. And papers were being published with researchers saying, we know what color T-Rex was. Here's a picture. And so this is tons of academic credibility. You know, and your listeners know, just what a big deal it is to be on the cover of Nature or Science. And so and here you have a PhD student writing a poster that says, I think you might be wrong. And that should trigger healthy debate. We should say, okay, well, what's your evidence? Huh. That's interesting. Let's repeat it. Let's try it again. Let's have a different lab try it. Let's all try it. It's not that expensive. We're burying feathers and looking at them under the microscope. This is not a big deal, folks.
Right.
Rather than doing that, the folks who were doing the screaming were threatened. And I was talking to one of my old friends in paleontology, and he said, you know, actually, I was at the conference in Germany the following year where she bravely produced more evidence and got screamed at again.
Yeah.
That the conference had to set ground rules on how researchers are allowed to behave on the conference room floor. And the fact that we get to that point, that people just can't have decorum, I find frustrating.
The terrible part of this story, Allison Moyer, the graduate student,
she's awesome.
So much. Yeah, but she left the field. She's teaching biology at Drexel now, I think.
Yep. Yeah. And,
what a loss.
Yeah, but I mean, this is the thing. We have a responsibility as scientists to pave the way for the next generation of thought. We should always be evolving. And actually, science isn't getting more creative. There's tons of evidence showing that we're actually slowing down in our creativity. And a huge part of that, I think, is competition. Both sabotaging ourselves by not being open to new ideas, but part of that's cultural. Looking at young people and being threatened by them because we don't want a new idea to challenge consensus. Dare we consider that we might be wrong? Postdocs not being able to speak up, PhD students not being able to speak up, women not being able to speak up, rival labs being rival labs in the first place, rather than being allies who are working together to solve a problem. The fact that we've got these cultural issues is not acceptable.
And that's why, echoing Albert Einstein here, you wrote, what we can do is remind scientists that we're all here for the sake of humanity, connected to one another through an inherent bond of sympathy. I like the spirit of that. But I think that by the time professional scientists are professional scientists, it might be too late. I think this ethic needs to be baked into scientific instruction from the first science lessons that children take when they are very little, all the way through graduate school and beyond. Alas, I don't think it is.
Well, I think it goes beyond just scientific training. I mean, my kid is 10 and she's in Britain. She's studying for her, what they call their SATs, which are their aptitude tests before you go into upper school. And these kids have to demonstrate competence in writing and mathematics and everything. Blessedly, their exams are not on a curve. But you know the day is coming soon when she's in upper school and the teacher will say, so, I gave out 3 A's, 9 B's, 15 C's, because we have to have a curve. And I don't think that such mechanisms teach our young people the right attitude about how to work together. I mean, I remember studying at Berkeley and having a professor who stood up and said, there will be 1 A+ at the end of this course. That person will come with me to Africa and accompany me as my assistant on the dig that I'm conducting. There will be this many A's. There will be this many A minuses. There will be this many B plus. But then there were team projects that we had to complete. And you really were not encouraged to work collaboratively with other people and help your fellow students. Because if you helped one of them climb their way up, that was just one less spot for you to get that A minus or B plus.
Yeah, we've seen this show. It's called Survivor.
Yeah. I mean, and the fact that this is how an undergraduate course at Berkeley was being taught is insane. It doesn't teach anybody good manners as a student. And I mean, and with that said, I mean, I see lots of scientists to this day who at conferences behave in exactly the same way. And it really, this kind of stuff, which is, I agree with you, baked in long before people get to university, needs to change.
That's Matt Kaplan. He's a science correspondent at The Economist. And his new book is I Told You So, Scientists Who Were Ridiculed, Exiled, and Imprisoned for Being Right. Matt Kaplan, thank you.
It's been my pleasure, Matt.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio. And if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you're not in Utah, you can still listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Public radio stations around the country have had substantial cuts to funding. So now more than ever, it's important to support this work if you are able. You can do that at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.